Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Overthrow 2 podcast. This is a collaboration between PhD and Eat Big Fish, and we're looking at a number of different brand owners talking about how a challenger mindset is helping them kind of navigate the business realities that they find themselves in. I'm Adam Morgan, the founder of Eat Big Fish, and on this episode, I'm going to be talking with Daniel Ordonez. Daniel is the SVP Chief Growth Officer for Dairy and Plant-Based at Danone. And he's going to be talking with me about what, for him, a challenger mindset means for a larger business, actually, for legacy brands even. And he's going to talk about, obviously, why challenger thinking isn't necessarily about being small or new, but what he personally has taken into his work and his team's work over the last couple of years. And after talking to Daniel, I'm going to be talking to Arvind Narasimhan. Arvind is the US Head of Communications at PhD, and he's going to draw from his own experience working on huge global clients who have themselves used a challenger mindset and challenger strategies to drive accelerated growth and brand value. But first, let's start with Daniel. So, well, look, Daniel, you and I have known each other for a while now, actually, and share a little bit about, you know, your own, you've always been a challenger, really, as long as I've known you within large organizations. Tell us a little bit about your own history as a challenger within large companies.
Thanks, Adam. Thanks for this invite. It's always a pleasure. Yeah, it's true. I mean, it's going to be almost 20 years soon, in a few years' time, when you and I were trying to make detergents, remember, a bit more exciting to people in those times in Unilever. Then it was like possibly a decade or so competing with the large beverages incumbent and trying to establish the flavored waters business in many countries around the world. And now, very lately, reinventing the dairy business in Danone and this amazing plant-based business opportunity we have in our hands, reaching some nice exponential growth there. So yes, Adam, it's true. I mean, almost 20 years, it seems like this Pirate Inside, if I recall correctly, that's your second book, right? Right. It was written for me. It was my prescription, actually. So thanks. Thanks for the invite.
Could you give us a sense about kind of the state of packaged goods at the moment, what kind of impetus and stimulus a new generation of challengers has given to it, and how you feel that you know the bigger players are responding to this stimulus?
Unprecedented times, indeed. CPG is at a crossroads, and there is no doubt about that, Adam. And there's been a lot being written over the years very recently. You know, I think that if we talk about brands for one second, most FMCGs have become very uninteresting to younger generations of consumers. Very, very uninteresting. For some time, we now see thousands of challenger brands that have a story to tell, not just their purpose, huh? It's just storytelling.
Yeah.
Have reinvented functionality. I mean, have you seen how many ingredient stories have become so interesting to people? Have made these transactional industrial packaging beautiful, desirable objects with lots of storytelling, printing, finishes, etc., etc. And I think predominantly what we see, Adam, is more and more brands that have a voice, that people and consumers can relate to the people that is behind the brand. Right. And you saw this 20 years ago, remember? I mean, you were talking about Virgin and Robin Hood and Innocent. Remember the early days of Innocent? And I think that has now, you know, moved very fast, Adam, from something emerging, right? So a bit awkward and some things that some hipsters would like to be dominant. I mean, all barriers. Now, if we move from brands into actual business, the change of paradigm is incredible. You know, I mean, all barriers have fallen. So every small player, every small challenger has access to the same manufacturing sites with co-packers, co-manufacturing facilities, can reach the shopper with e-commerce in very simple manners or the new distributors that are popping up. Adam, you know, it's true. Many people say that these challenger, most of these challenger or insurgents brands die over the years. And it's true. I mean, I think I shared this with you before that over 90% of these brands die when we did a study a few years ago in China. But more and more come in because the barriers of entries have fallen. So inexorably, the landscape changes, and brands have never been so interesting for people as a result. So you ask me about established players, and I believe that today there is no choice for established players that sit up, take notice, and become more interesting for these younger generations of consumers.
So brilliant. So let me pick up on a couple of things there. So you talk about the word interesting a lot and brands being interesting. What how did they become dull? I mean, what is that? Just they always were dull, and actually you only just noticed that because these newer, more interesting competitors came along? Or do you think that actually for all that we've understood about, oh, I don't know, how to improve, you know, our performance on the core levers of marketing, actually, we still haven't really understood or spent enough attention on making brands stimulating and interesting in a very noisy, crowded world?
Indeed, indeed. Well, honestly, I mean, we have become transactional, right? Large right. companies have commoditized categories. So how come? Well, by applying time and time again the same different methods. And the reality, Adam, is that while the basics and the foundations of business and marketing haven't changed, the playbook of how to craft a brand has substantially changed. We are living right. in a completely different paradigm today.
Tell us about de-averaging, because you've talked to me a lot in the past about de-averaging, and I'm very interested in that concept of yours. Tell us about what that means to you and how you've been working with your teams to apply it and the results that it's led to.
Well, it's true. It's true. Well, the concept of de-averaging is very, very interesting. You know, I was referring to the Nielsen or IRI report. Now, the reality that growth is everywhere. If you look in different places, it's hidden in the blurred lines. So things are fluid today. So it's hidden in the blurred lines of the Excel spreadsheet. Mm-hmm. So if you're expecting everything to be given to you in a silver platter of a market research report, it won't be there. You need to go and hunt for that growth space, for that growth opportunity. So it doesn't come nicely packed in that report any longer. That's the beauty of the averaging. So it starts with observation. You know that as you have done for the last 20 plus years, I have dedicated a lot of my past few years observing them around the world, right? So if you go to the West Coast in the US, you go to New York or China, there are a lot of interesting, Taiwan, lots of interesting things going on. And you start observing these small brands, challenger brands, and the techniques they used. And there is a lot about observing what happens in the most exciting stores. Mm. Bring your teams with you. You know, practice what they do at all times. I mean, refuse to put things into boxes. You see what I mean? And that's where this important concept of the averaging comes to mind.
You talk a lot about storytelling and storytelling in brands. And I was just wondering, how has that affected the way you think about the way you use media, for instance? So I mean, because it's a story, you mean storytelling on pack? You mean storytelling in the way we think about the media channels we go through or the messages we put out, or is it some combination of all of those? How's your sense of media and the role and the nature of your media choices changed as you've lent more into this new model?
I think Overthrow speaks loads about the importance of effectiveness over efficiency. And I think if we're not careful, we would find that the notion of precision marketing, that is, by the way, very badly needed and super necessary as a technique of contemporary marketing, could prevent us from the broader point of view that a brand should hold to be actually interesting to people. So from, you know, the DNA, the point of view and the DNA the brand has vis-a-vis a societal issue.
Tell me about, you know, you've been leading a challenger mindset in large organizations for a while. And this seems to be, you know, the really exciting kind of point for you within your role at Danone. What do you think it takes from all the experience you've had and indeed from this kind of very rich set of recent experiences? What does it take to really lead a challenger mindset in a large organization? And what advice would you have from somebody who was listening to this and wanted to do the same thing? Again, in a large, you know, potentially bureaucratic, perhaps matrix-driven organization. What have you learned and what would you advise?
I would start with humility of strategy, I would say. Depending whether you are in a big transformation as we had to overcome on the over the last few years or no, know where you're going, but don't be fixed on how to get there. You know, avoid the dogma. I mean, there is something heavily ingrained in large organizations that they are tend to be dogmatic about. This is how you do things here.
Yeah.
And celebrate the pivoting, celebrate the risk and the speed to market. Accept that what has to be adjusted is you and not the marketplace.
Yeah.
You know, that's very, very important. Then I would then move to playing a little bit about your original Eat the Big Fish book. There is no doubt that you have to overcommit. You really need to like what you're doing because you have to overcommit to transform a reality. I shared this with you the other day, this quote from the current CEO of Qantas that said, that's a company that had to undergo a large transformation. And he said something like this. He said, "You don't transform a business by aiming at gaining a popularity contest."
I love that.
So you will have to be, accept that you will have to be polarizing, and being polarizing is not necessarily something that is makes you very popular in a large organization. And you have to mind less about hierarchies and process and assume that you have to display visible committed leadership at all points.
Tell me about your experience during lockdowns. What's it helped you sort of think about or see differently, perhaps, or kind of crystallized in your thinking that you found useful as you think about the future?
We have dramatically, as I think for most people, dramatically changed the way in which we work. We have stopped, for instance, all business reviews. I remember 4 months ago with Paco asking ourselves the question, oh my God, what are we going to do? I mean, him and I used to be on a plane 24/7, and now we had to decide how we will conduct business. So, and our first decisions were to stop all the business reviews, allow the local teams to operate in the crisis. So the first measure was to say, okay, we stop all these and we give you all the time back. At the same time, we started with my teams here in Paris to put some guidance that we started to issue weekly and bi-weekly to the teams, not just marketing, but, sales, R&D, and the broader business strategy on how business should ideally be conducted. Because the beauty of these, board, central roles is that you have the visibility about the global picture. We knew exactly how China was already developing. We had some learnings to apply. So those guidances helped a lot, and at the same time backing off. So, Adam, my biggest learning out of this is that we have abandoned any illusion of control. We backed off and we had no choice but to trust the local teams to get on and operate in the crisis. Now, that was in the short term, and as you know, it bears some fruits. At the same time, we dedicated a team full on the what we thought was a big thought at the moment. Now that every company has came up with something similar, which we called it the day after, right? So a team of talented people thinking on a bit about foresight and how things will look after the confusion of the crisis will start clearing out a little bit. And what insights and shifts were likely to stick after the hardest part of the lockdown, of the confinement. And we're now implementing those insights into new product ideas, new activations, and new campaigns. It's fascinating. It's fascinating. So as I said before, speed of pivoting, it's a bit second nature. It has become second nature to us. So I must say that no one was very surprised about how fast we could adapt and follow where the consumer was going.
Well, and so good. All right. So thank you. So finally, take us into the kind of look, the lockdown has been an inflection point for all of us, but also for this new generation of challenges. And clearly within packaged goods, some of that some of those challenges are going to struggle if they haven't already disappeared, and some of them are clearly still thriving and forging ahead. How do you think it's, tell us about what you think this means, this the after effects of lockdown mean for the next generation of challengers, and who you think is going to thrive and who will in fact fall away?
That's another fascinating one, Adam. Indeed. Listen, there is no doubt that the pandemic and the lockdown have brought lots of traditional barriers back up. And, you know, companies like Danone are benefiting from that. So people shop more in established supermarkets. Even the corner shop has become, in Europe, for instance, your one-stop shop, and much less on the go. So urbanization, in a way, will pause. In fact, you and I have read a lot about people going out to more non-urban areas. So people will have also gone back to trusted, established, safe, and well-known brands. If you wanted to be support your immunity system, if you wanted to support your gut health, you really go back to trusted, recognized brands. And those trusted, recognized businesses have an installed capacity to leverage. And that has been, no doubt, a big, big competitive advantage in the short term. So who will prevail? Challengers have to rely in their in their market capacity. You know, the same co-packers, distributors, and are really struggling, and have many of them have disappeared over the last few months, in only a few weeks. So the jury's out. But you know, I believe, Adam, that the challengers that are backed up by good cash, so venture capitals, and we have a differentiated product proposition, a solid business model, and there are so many of them, there is no doubt that they will prevail. And I see for us, the large companies, it's a huge inflection point. I call it the extra bonus opportunity that these tragic circumstances are giving the established players, right? The established incumbents. So many previously uninteresting brands are seeing growth now, because they became this safe haven for people in some categories, right? But I think this is possibly the biggest mistake these large incumbents can make, that believe that the lessons we learned over the last decade have gone. And we take this opportunity to default back to the old habits of becoming transactional again. So the marketing playbook of a challenger brand, of a challenger business, have not changed at all. Only the context has. You see, those who find comfort in the pandemic, believing the good old days are back, will lose this extra opportunity the circumstances are giving them. And if the established players read the moment well, they have an incredible opportunity to leapfrog into this new paradigm for brands, for people, for consumers.
Yes, absolutely. And as you say, recognizing that those overall shifts are still there, they've been paused for a little bit. So there's created more space and time for the incumbent to respond, but it will come back again. Daniel, thank you.
Thanks, Adam. It's been a pleasure and an honor, actually, that after so many years, you thought about me and our journey to make it available for everyone who's listening to this. Thanks so much.
Fabulous. Thank you. So very interesting interview with Daniel Ordonez. And now I'm joined by Arvin. And Arvin, you spend much of your time, really, your bread and butter in many ways, is actually bringing the power of challenger mindset and challenger thinking to large, very often global brands in the US. What did you find particularly relevant and striking in what Daniel said?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the things that stood out to me most and probably earliest in the conversation was how often the idea of being interesting came up. And, you know, that could seem a little bit obvious, but particularly in a world where the conversation is so often dominated by tools, tech, and data, all of it, I think, is a reminder that especially in these current times we're in, none of that matters if we can't actually be interesting out in culture and to people out in the world.
So tell us a little bit, what's your experience of those two things? How do you help plants the average? And tell me a little bit about kind of, I know you talk about kind of breakthroughs happen in the wild. Tell us a bit more about that idea.
Yeah, I love the notion of de-averaging, and it's so important in particular for the largest of brands in the world. Can be particularly easy, you know, as any client could relate, to sort of rest back once you've reached a certain size or you've dominated a certain category to kind of say, we're humming along, we're doing okay. But mm-hmm. I love the notion of always kind of challenging, no matter what position you're in, even if you're the market leader, to sort of say, there's some things that are still average about us. And how do we kind of always look between the lines? Daniel had this notion of the spreadsheet, the market forecast, that's not really going to tell you how to de-average yourself. It's really kind of getting out into the world to really understand through human observation, through intuition, how those things really happen. And in the past, worked for a major credit card brand, and oftentimes in that category, it's sort of very much a commodity fight where brands are offering a lot of the same things, a lot of the same products, a lot of the same cards with a lot of the same benefits. And one of the interesting places where they're trying to find some unique places and de-average themselves is, how do you create more authentic experiences for your customers, for your cardholders? How do you unlock new ways for them to experience the world? And one of the things that we helped this brand do was really understand, well, how can you be, when you think about challenger mentalities, if you want to be, for example, a local hero to people, really helping them get the most out of their cities, the best kind of experiences in the places they live and where they like to play. How do you really do that? And what you won't do, what you can't really find, is through census reports or MRI runs that are focused on where people live. It's really about kind of getting on the ground, talking to people who live in those cities, talking to local experts, really understanding kind of, for example, what makes a city tick? What is it that people really want from a brand that they're not getting today? What does an authentic experience look like in a place that could help a credit card brand actually authentically show up out in the world?
And I imagine there's a tension in all of that, isn't there? In the sense that there is a drive towards kind of efficiency and pace and using what we have already, and you know, that kind of getting out there is a much more inefficient kind of high energy kind of personally intensive process. But yet your point is it's very important. So how did that actually work in the conversation with the client? Tell us a bit more about how that actually worked.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, and it was a tough conversation, because so often in the world of marketing, it feels like every couple of years the pendulum swings to one extreme or the other. You know, we're not an industry that sort of deals in moderation. If a few years ago, call it 5, 10 years ago, it was all about kind of classic brand building, big creative ideas out in the world, do things that are noticed. In the last few years, we've kind of swung towards exactly what you're saying, that kind of efficiency play of, if we invest in sort of more money in programmatic, more money in sort of tactics that we know are going to be efficient, tactics that we can trace back to the dollar and cent, tactics that we can trace back to sort of one-to-one, yes, those things will deliver for you in the near term. Yes, it could deliver against your short-term goals. What we start to lose in those sorts of moments are the longer-term value of, how do you build a brand that is, to Daniel's point, interesting over the long term, that is valuable over the long term, that all other things considered, why would somebody actually choose you? And for that brand in particular, when we think about de-averaging and, you know, in a category like credit cards, if we just fought on sort of the near term and the sort of dollars and cents of it, we knew that we would lose. You're going to lose that next generation of people who are going to get a credit card, say, 5 years down the line. What are they really choosing on? Because you could swap out the different logos on your bank card. Maybe it doesn't really mean that much to people, but if you're actually a brand that's offering something substantive, offering something that this can actually help me unlock new ways to see my city, new ways to experience life, new ways to enjoy my time out with my friends, that becomes a very different conversation than rates and APRs. It becomes a conversation now around, does this brand actually fit into the life that you want? Does it sort of supplement and augment the things that you want to do, versus just, does it meet your transactional need when you're at a register or when you're buying something on Amazon?
Tell me a little bit about flexibility. So I know this struck you as much as it did me, which is, so you know, bigger businesses, bigger clients, as you and I know, because we've worked and continue to work with a lot of them. Flex isn't historically at the heart of their modus operandi, and yet here he is talking about the fact that one needs to have flex kind of built into one's approach. What's your sense of how much you're seeing of that in reality, and why you think it might be important?
It's really an interesting kind of tension, especially in a time where we live in a world where we have more data than ever. We can measure more than we've ever before. We can know precisely what our actions are doing in near real time. And what I thought was really interesting in your conversation was what an unexpected almost outcome of our current COVID environment and potentially the new normal after that is we've realized how many things are potentially unnecessary that may have seemed rigorous 6 months ago, but that now seem quite honestly like they're slowing us down. Example kind of was, do we really need to travel around the world and have sort of 2-day, 3-day process and business assessment meetings? Probably not, because one, we can't get on planes and travel around the world. And two, are we better suited by saying, okay, we all have our eye on that end zone. We know what the vision is. Let's just let kind of our teams execute from there and get to where they need to go.
How will this change you? Having lived through lockdown, how are you going to show up or participate in or behave differently, do you think, going in the future from when you went into it? Just give us one instance of how you think it might change you.
I think what this experience has taught me and what I've seen in working with our clients is really the value of sticking to your convictions. Our clients are turning to us for advice on not just what is the thing that we need to communicate now, but how do we weather through this? How do we survive? How do we make it through to the other side? How do we really go on as a business in a world that has completely changed? And I think it's hard to know whether you're going to be totally right or totally wrong, because all of us are sort of writing the playbook for this new world in near real time. There's no precedent for it. But the value of sticking to your beliefs, of having conviction, of saying, we have a point of view. We believe this is the right way to go. We may be 70% right. We may be 80% right. We might be 40% right. But what we need is to believe in, we know the right thing to do, and having belief in that and kind of moving forward. That I think is hopefully something that we've rediscovered as an industry, as strategists, as marketing professionals. So professionally, I think that's the big kind of thing that I'm taking away from this.
Arvind, thank you. That was great. Really enjoyed having you on the podcast.
Adam, thanks for having me. Always a pleasure.
Well, that's it for today. Thank you once again for joining us for the Overthrow 2 podcast. And thank you for Daniel and Arvind for their insights on how brands of all sizes can use challenger mindset and challenger narratives. To learn more about challenger strategies, if you're interested, and which you or your brand most aligns with, there's an interactive test you can take at overthrow2.com that's fun and might kind of stimulate your appetite a bit more. And meanwhile, we look forward to speaking to you next time.